Hi everyone, it's Kevin J, the best thing since The Road. And you're listening to The Therapy Suite right here on UKF Radio, the world's number one talk health radio. On this week's Therapy Suite, I talked to Professor Sux Minas about male fertility and erectile challenges. Welcome to the show, Professor Minas. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thanks very much, Kevin. Thanks for inviting us on.
Look, thanks for taking the time out. I know you have busy days, as you mentioned before. So really appreciate your time. Look, I think it'd be great if you could just tell us a bit more about yourself, your background, and how you got to where you are today.
Sure. So I'm a professor in urology, in particular andrology, which is the study of the male reproductive system. I work at Imperial College Healthcare, and a lot of the work I do is based upon male genitals. So in other words, I kind of either investigate male infertility, treat it, and also are also a reconstructive surgeon for the genital region as well, treating problems in men basically for erectile dysfunction, fertility, and things like trauma, patients who might have Peyronie's disease, bends in the penis. So anything really to do with the male genital system is what I treat. How I got into it? Well, that's another story. But on the other hand, I've trained as a urologist and specialized in the speciality, what we term as andrological surgery. So that's what I do, basically.
Sounds very complicated. I mean, I've spoken to many, surgeons and doctors, professors, et cetera, in the past, but especially that region. And it's a very sensitive topic as well. And I mean, talking to some of your patients, clients, et cetera, it must be quite traumatizing for them to kind of go psychologically through the whole thing.
Yeah, it's a difficult area, isn't it? Because it's not something that most men will want to talk about, particularly, you know, with colleagues and particularly, you know, to friends even, because it's a very personal area. So you're talking about your own kind of anatomy, your own perceptions, which are kind of have been reconfigured throughout your whole life and formulated ideas in your head throughout your own experiences in life. So it's a very personalized area, which can be difficult. It can be difficult for patients to open up and talk about these problems. And sometimes in many patients, these are kind of deep-rooted problems that they've had since childhood. And often it's the first time, even in late adulthood, that they come and approach you about a particular problem. They may have even had families, they may have even had relationships, but can never really talk to their partner either. So it's an extremely sensitive area, and it's a very difficult area because obviously it affects patients' quality of life in terms of not only fertility, but also their sexual function, which is really, of course, very important to people.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's what makes man feel like a man, etc. So, and that's why when I saw the topic and I was like, oh gosh, this is, you know, it must be quite challenging at times when you're talking to the person and explaining what's going on and giving them an idea of what's going to happen next and that kind of thing. So, I mean, look, talk to us about fertility issues in men. What exactly is it?
Sure. Well, fertility issues are very common, actually. I mean, 1 in 7 couples have difficulty conceiving, which is quite a large number. I mean, you can imagine, couldn't you, if this was a cancer and you said that 1 in 7 people are going to have a cancer, there'd be almost uproar about this. So it's very common. So 15% of couples have difficulty conceiving. And the definition of difficulty conceiving is a year of unprotected intercourse and failure to conceive. Now, some couples may also have difficulty after they've had a child as well. And there can be many problems that can cause that. Now, historically, it's always been the female partner in a relationship has always been investigated. So in many ways, women will undergo the relevant investigations and tests. But if we then think that almost 50% of cases are due to a male factor, you then begin to realize that how common the problem is. So, for example, if you look at fertility problems, about 1% of men, for example, in the population won't have any sperm in the ejaculation, which is pretty high if you think about it, 1 in 100 men. Equally, as I said already, that, you know, 50% of the problems are due to a male factor. So it's kind of underestimated the effects. In particular, often men aren't investigated and often are left on their own. It's very difficult, of course, also to get sources of information from the website. It's a very personal matter. A lot of people don't want to talk about fertility. As you said, it's also about, in a sense, being a man. And if you're kind of told your sperm count is low, then of course that can have a detrimental effect on your psychology as well. Needless to say, also, of course, when couples are trying to conceive, you've got to remember that there's a lot of pressure on the guy. And in a sense, this kind of sex becomes very much a kind of a regimented and very much a kind of a process whereby you're having children. And that, in a sense, they lose their enjoyment. And that can also cause quite a few problems, interpersonal relationship problems, and also, of course, erectile dysfunction. So I think it's an extremely sensitive area. It's very common. And I think we underestimate the effects. We've also got to look at the fact that not only is it about fertility, and of course the end point, of course, in patients is wanting to have kids, isn't it, ultimately? But we've also got to remember, as we'll talk, I'm sure, shortly, about the effects in terms of fertility and the fact that men with lower sperm counts have and can harbour other diseases.
Oh, of course. You mentioned something about the couples. Can this kind of situation lead to relationship breakdowns? Have you come across that, where there's challenges in the relationship because of the fertility issues?
Yes, definitely. And I think that that's a really big problem. And if you, you know, the whole situation is very stressful. I think we also got to look at the kind of political landscape about fertility treatment. If patients are trying, they're unable to conceive, they then need to be referred on to specialists in the area. Particularly on the NHS, we do have post-COVID long waiting times. That's around the whole country for these type of treatments and these type of investigations. That in itself can be stressful for families. My own experience is in terms of couples, you know, they've been waiting a long time during COVID, want to get on and move forwards. At the same time, the female partner's getting older. And therefore, we know that even if you're going to consider IVF fertility treatments, then the female age is, of course, very important in terms of outcomes and in terms of success rates. So it creates an enormous anxiety, not surprisingly and understandably, for the couple. And their journey, of course, can be very mixed. It can be very fragmented. If we look at the way the current streamlining of the healthcare system is not as good as perhaps we'd really want it to be. But of course, there is a big backlog of seeing patients on the NHS in that context.
Has fertility issues become more common, do you think, over time?
Yeah, and I think that particularly in men, I mean, if we look at women, for example, women we know have children at an older age. I mean, that's been well documented. And it's also been documented, of course, women having to freeze their eggs or try to freeze their eggs, who may, of course, be pursuing careers. And I think this is the kind of the sadness in terms of our society, that, of course, that having a family and having children is fulfilling and very important for couples. In men, of course, in particular, we know historically that sperm counts have deteriorated in the last 50 years. And in fact, if you look at fertility outcomes in terms of semen analysis, for example, sperm counts have gone down. Now, why that is, nobody truly knows, but the theory, there are multiple theories to account for that. We think probably industrialization and probably environmental factors and exposure to chemicals, such as what we term as something called endocrine disrupting chemicals, which are chemicals found in pesticides, plastics, which are thought to have estrogenizing effects in utero, in other words, when the cells are divided in men, which then has a kind of dysfunctional effect on sperm production and hormone production, the so-called testicular dysgenesis theory. So we think that that's probably the cause. In fact, testicular dysgenesis is a syndrome whereby you not only get abnormalities in fertility and certain genitourinary problems, but actually there's also an increased chance or risk of testis cancer. And to mirror that, interestingly, as semen parameters have deteriorated, the risk of testis cancer has increased in the population overall, anything between 2 to 4-fold in the last 50 years. Now, the reason, again, is that there's clearly a relationship, and the relationship or interrelationship is probably these chemicals that we believe have an adverse effect on the testicle itself in utero. So there is an intimate relationship between the two. So men's fertility has been declining. At the same time, testis cancer incidence has been increasing. But if you look at the survival rates, of course, survival rates have fallen in most countries around the world. So we shouldn't worry about survival. But actually what's happened is there's a higher incidence of this. And this seems to be very much related to industrialization or the Western world, in particular in the Western societies.
So it sounds like pollution's possibly, or things, you know, food wise, etc., that kind of thing, contamination, because, you know, food is not as organic as it used to be. So, and I know this is all a theory, basically. Yeah. So we don't know for sure, but it sounds like there, you know, there might be issues there. Also, has there been an increase in men experiencing erectile dysfunction?
Yeah, there has been. And I think that the, again, not so much perhaps an increase so much in terms of fertility, where you can kind of measure objectively fertility, yeah, by doing a sperm test. But if you look at men and you look at the kind of erectile dysfunction, men are more prone now to come forward. We also know, again, just with fertility, that erectile dysfunction may be a sentinel or harbinger of other more serious diseases like cardiovascular disease, for example, diabetes. And so therefore, erectile dysfunction may precede some of these conditions. So whilst, of course, we don't necessarily see an absolute increase, there are many studies suggesting that erectile dysfunction is far more common than actually what we think. Through many large studies in Europe and also Asian studies, which have suggested that the rate of erectile dysfunction increases quite rapidly. In fact, you know, 50% of men in their 40s going up to probably 60, 70% higher as people get older. So it is very common. But I think there's more focus now because of our understanding of its association with erectile dysfunction and cardiovascular disease has improved. And obviously, we understand more about that.
Very interesting. We're just going to go to a quick ad break and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
So, Professor Minnis, basically, in terms of challenges that men have, I mean, are men dealing with male fertility issues well at all?
I think they are. I think they're becoming more and more aware of this. But it's interesting, isn't it, that often the male partner is not really investigated. I think with social media platforms, I think with more kind of charities out there dealing with male infertility, particularly, for example, like the Fertility Show, people are becoming much more aware. The problem is, of course, is that we also need to highlight, of course, that it's not just about the fertility. I mean, we mentioned about erectile dysfunction and its association with cardiovascular disease equally. If you look back at the whole issue of infertility, you will also see a higher risk of cardiovascular disease, might be related to low testosterone, something called metabolic syndrome. Therefore, men who have infertility problems might be more prone to developing cardiovascular disease and having higher mortality rates. Likewise, they're more prone to developing cancers. It's interesting, not only cancers of the testicle, which as we already talked about, but that theory of endocrine disrupting chemicals, but also the risk of other cancers, thyroid cancers, gastrointestinal cancers as well. So it's become very complex, the whole issue of this. And men, I think, although are more aware generally, because obviously there's more focus on the male partner more and more, but I think ultimately they're still not investigated and still not treated as perhaps or investigated as much as women. So I think there much needs to be much more focus, much more dedication, and much more streamlining of that service throughout the UK, throughout Europe. And I think this is one of the problems that we face. I think raising the profile of male infertility is very important for those factors as well. And of course, as you already mentioned, Gavin, the stress that people go in trying to have children, the psychology of this, you know, when they face seeing other couples, other partners, you know, having kids, and they see that and being invited to christenings. I mean, I had one patient who was telling me that he tried to avoid seeing his friends because they were all having kids, and he wasn't able to have kids. And actually, it was quite a big thing. We've also got to remember the social and cultural issues of this as well. If we look at ethnic groups, various ethnic groups, they won't talk about this. And of course, family members and in close-knit families and extended families, they do talk about this quite a lot. We'll often ask, you know, why haven't you had children yet? And this is a huge issue. And therefore, it places the couple in a very vulnerable situation, a very difficult situation. So there are many social and cultural issues about this as well. I think we also got to look at it and say, well, look, there's also about awareness. There's also a lot of economic issues as well, access to care as well. So in terms of patients from certain groups of society may have more availability of treatment, depending upon financially how much money they have. So economically, of course, that's also a major factor in terms of being able to attain the right advice, the right messages, and the right treatments. So I think there is a disproportionate number of patients who probably aren't seeing clinicians, who aren't having the right investigations done for social, cultural, and economic reasons, which just has a huge impact on the couple, without a doubt.
Of course. I mean, the person, the male, for example, I'm sure both the couple, male and female, go through a lot emotionally. The male that's experiencing the challenges, especially, I mean, low moods, depression. Do you hear kind of people along those lines? And, you know, do they have to seek additional support for that area as well?
They do. And I think that when you see patients just on an anecdotal basis, you can see that there's a lot of strain within relationships when you see that. Equally, the male partner, you can see, is probably kind of really... A lot of this is really led by the female partner in many cases. I mean, I'm pleased more and more men are being proactive, but often they kind of feel shunned a little bit out of the pathway because a lot of the time the treatment is very much female-centric in the context of IVF treatments, and therefore they feel kind of slightly separated from all of this. And sometimes they want an answer. And the problem here, of course, is that we don't really have an answer often in probably about 50% of cases, or up to 50% of cases. There isn't a known answer why the male fertility is impaired, so-called unexplained infertility. Now, the other issue is, of course, is stress. I mean, there are many studies out there showing that the quality of life is poorer in men. Men suffer more ED, more problems in terms of depression. And there are a number of studies now kind of focusing on this, showing, of course, that it can affect or have a profound effect on relationships. So I think it is a very difficult time for a couple who can't conceive. We must, of course, remember that many of these definitions are arbitrary in a sense. We always define, you know, about 75% of couples conceived by 1 year, 95% by 2 years. But of course, there are, of course, variations to that, which we mustn't forget. So, of course, with the pressures that people are under, as we already mentioned about couples, their friends, their families, the social, the cultural issues, we also got to remember that time sometimes is a healer, and the fact waiting a little bit longer sometimes does work. We always got to take into account women's age, that after the age of 35, fertility does decline in women. It's been well documented, certainly by 40. So we've also got to take that into account as well in terms of decision making. But at the same time, try not to pressurize couples into saying that there is a problem here.
Do the men initiate, you know, getting help first, or do you find that it's the partner that's kind of brought the person forward to be able to get help?
I think in a lot of cases, actually, it's the female or the partner that actually pushes the male to come forward. So they're the ones who are driving it for many reasons. I mean, because of the focus really on female age, whether that's wrong or right, of course, is debatable. It's often the female partner that is driving the male in order to try and push this forward. So this does create problems in that sense. So the man is often coming along, and it's interesting that often they won't have a test done until quite late on, and often the female partner's had all the tests done, and then suddenly somebody will say, well, actually, what about the guy? Why don't we do some tests on him. Why don't we do a sperm test? And you suddenly find that there might be no sperm, or there might be very few sperm, or there might be a problem in the sperm. So I think it's largely driven by women, but that's understandable because of the focus on the female age and female fertility and the decline in female fertility.
Do you think couples understand male fertility issues when trying to conceive?
I think they do more and more, and I think there's a lot of information out there now with charities, with self-help groups, with couples who've gone through the fertility journey themselves, and so they have a lot of experience and are a great source of reference and support for couples. I mean, there are many websites out there which specifically, you know, are discussion forums for couples, and I think therefore patients have actually taken it upon themselves to drive the agenda much more, and I think that's been very helpful for clinicians, so they come with much more understanding. And of course, with social media platforms, with access to data, with access to studies and literature, patients are much more well-informed now. So I think there has been a change, but I think there needs to be more input and more impetus and more focus on the male.
Of course, I totally forgot. And you've got YouTube as well. So there must be loads of information on YouTube. And I'm sure there must be people that provide, you know, give their experiences about what might have happened, what's going on, providing information. Do you find some people come to you and there's a bit of overkill with the analysis?
I think to a degree. I think that many patients or couples want an answer. I mean, yes, in a lot of cases we can, but in a significant number we can't. And so that even applies to IVF treatments, why IVF treatments might not work. So I think they are, in a sense, much better read. And sometimes the problem is that when you read data and a lot of the studies that we see, the data, if you look at studies, are defined as either weak or strong. And many of these studies are quite weak, partly because of the nature of the way they're conducted. They're not randomized studies. They're studies that don't have a placebo. So, for example, if you look at a certain effects of a drug or multivitamins, most of the studies you see are often not placebo controlled. In other words, having a placebo effect. So I think it's very difficult, but they're often armed with information that may be of poor quality data. Having said that, that's the data we have, and that's the unfortunate nature of the kind of science behind what we're dealing with, because the science we have is not very well funded. So a lot of the research we do is difficult to fund. It's not cancer-based. It's not having such a profound impact in terms of life or quality of life, in terms of outcome or quantity of life. So therefore, much of the funding that we receive is very kind of soft funding. And what we actually need is trials. We need also centres to collaborate. So in terms of data acquisition, patients are much more informed. But I think the data that we have is very much very mixed and can be very actually contradictory. In terms of, you know, what to do. For example, you know, marathon running, bicycle riding, the effects of alcohol, the effects of smoking, which no doubt do have an effect. But on the other hand, the level of that effect, or alternatively, the magnitude of that effect can be overestimated as well. So what that requires is good quality studies, collaboration, and scientists working together. So I think it's the process for clinicians should be filtering that data and presenting it in a much more logical and perhaps more palatable manner, in which patients can understand the limitations of some of this data. In particular, you know, again, one of the problems you mentioned, YouTube, is that some of these data, whilst it exists, may scientifically, what we would define, be of not of great quality data, or poor quality of data, or weak evidence.
Does data show that alcohol, smoking, etc. can cause issues?
Yeah, I think any lifestyle. I mean, I think that you need, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, obesity, being overweight, can affect male sperm. We also know that recreational drug use, we also know that we're having bodybuilding drugs and anabolic steroids. I mean, you know, a lot of people go to the gym. Are they aware that, of course, that anabolic steroids, testosterone, will impair your fertility, will actually cause lower sperm counts? That many people aren't aware of this, and it's a £1 billion industry that is anabolic steroid use, but actually will impair male infertility. Many men won't realize this. Alcohol, smoking, as we also mentioned, are factors as well. So there are a lot of lifestyle issues. If you look at diet and data on diet, of course, it's very mixed, but certainly living a healthy lifestyle exercising regularly and making sure you're not overweight, eating the right foods, you know, may certainly impact upon fertility. But again, if we look at data, particularly regarding food and foodstuffs, again, there's not a huge amount of data. And as I mentioned, again, the quality and level of evidence is there, but it's not great data. So therefore, but it would make sense. It would be intuitive, wouldn't it not, to actually eat healthily, live healthily, which potentially you would should improve and should, certainly hopefully help your fertility.
Are there any foods that can do, basically food that provides that extra bit of help to help with fertility?
Well, we talk about, we in terms of particular foods, we talk about a Mediterranean-type diet, and that's just a healthy diet to reduce weight, containing antioxidants, so taking out starches, fried foods, eating white meats, trying to avoid red meats, eating salads, tomatoes, nuts. And the argument being that these type of diets may result in weight loss, which might then not only affect sperm counts, but also affect what we term as the DNA integrity, the actual DNA of the sperm as well. There are some studies suggesting that. But in terms of if you were going to say to a patient, what type of diet should I aim for, then taking a Mediterranean type diet would seem logical, both for weight loss, both for general health, long-term cardiovascular health in general.
Are people waiting longer to conceive?
I think it's a difficult question to answer. I think in some couples, again, it's very much social and cultural, and it's something that people don't want to kind of come forwards. They feel embarrassed. They feel that they are, you know, somebody's pointing a finger, as we already said about masculinity, about being able to conceive. So all these factors take into account. If you think about it, if it's not a life-threatening event, most people will try and avoid coming forwards. Having said that, if you look at cancers, in terms of all cancers, people do take their time because they're worried, they're scared, not surprisingly. And I think the key message to all of this is that if you're worried about your fertility, then go and see your specialist and come forwards and try and deal with it early. As we said, what we don't want to be seeing is, you know, couples waiting 4, 5, 6 years to try and conceive, and then suddenly we find a problem in the male or the female partner. And therefore, I think it should be positively encouraged to come forwards. And certainly if you haven't conceived by 1 year of unprotected intercourse, then you should be moving towards getting a specialist opinion. And one could argue that that should be lower, 6 months, certainly women above the age of 35 to 37, where we term as what their ovarian reserve falls. In other words, their fertility potential. Therefore, it may be quicker, it may be more logical to come earlier by 6 months. So I think my message probably is to say, don't be afraid to come forward if you have concerns. I mean, there are certain other conditions in men that we need to be aware of. For example, men who might have had undescended testes as a child. It's quite incredible that if you have undescended testes as a child, you're at higher risk of not only testis cancer, but also you're at higher risk of infertility. But many men don't realise that. Many men have not actually been told that either. So I think there's an awful lot and an awful lot of stuff that needs to be kind of discussed, and also from the point of view of having this information being available to couples.
We're just going to another quick ad break and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So basically, apart from age, waiting longer to conceive has its own issues. Can you go into a bit more detail about that? I know there's an age factor, but we'll put that aside. If we're waiting longer, what are some of the challenges?
Well, I think it's both for the male and female partner. We know that semen parameters deteriorate after the age of 40 in men. DNA changes occur where you get disruption of sperm DNA, so-called fragmentation, after the age of 40 in women. Of course, we've got to remember, and in men as well, there's a higher risk of having congenital problems such as Down syndrome after the age of 40. So we've got to be aware of those factors, even if you're having IVF treatments. So I think it's important. Obviously, you can't say to a couple, because it's about life and about their own lives and their own personal lives, that to try early or sooner, because obviously relationships differ, people's expectations differ, careers differ. But we certainly know after the age of 40, we begin to see not only the outcomes from treatments such as IVF falling, but also the risk of congenital malformations after the age of 40. So I think that we obviously need to kind of get that message across. But on the other hand, it's very difficult, isn't it? Because we're all individuals, we all have choice, and we all have our own lives to live. And culturally, socially, work-wise, they may differ hugely between couples.
Of course, yeah. It sounds, yeah, there's a lot of challenges there, some that I wasn't aware of. I mean, do work-related stress cause performance issues in men?
Yeah, I think in terms of erectile dysfunction, without a doubt. So the first thing I ask patients who come and see me with erectile dysfunction is to ask them, is what do you do for work? How stressed are you? And you find often that a lot of guys will be stressed. They do very, very high intensity jobs. They may be working shift systems. And so there's a lot you've got to ask in the social history. The other thing, of course, is the couples. You know, when are they meeting? How often are they having intercourse in terms of erectile function, of course? There may be, obviously, the guy coming in from work, or the partner coming in from work, maybe coming at different times. Somebody may be at home longer. Their expectations or their time that they want to have sex may be completely different from their partner's time. So all of this needs to be taken into account. Stress is a major factor, without a doubt. There may be many causes of stress, not only work-related stress, but also in terms of financial stress, lots of things. If you talk to couples as well, they often, their erectile function will improve after they've been on holiday or during holiday, because they're relaxed and able to kind of think about things more and relax a little bit more. So stress is very important in terms of erectile function, without a doubt.
Have people actually spoken to you about their stress about, you know, money situations, the way society is, etc., that have actually led to and resulted in them not being able to perform that well?
Yeah, I mean, some patients will allude to the fact, they won't go into particularly about financially, but they will allude to the fact that they have multiple stresses in their life. They may have lost a family member. They may have lost their partner. They may therefore have difficulty actually forming relationships again. And there's always, in a sense, particularly in terms of stress related to relationships, if they've lost a partner, broken up with somebody, there's that kind of loss, that grieving period, almost a sense of guilt, particularly with those patients that may have lost a partner, sadly, due to many reasons. So I think there is that sense of guilt. Therefore, we mustn't underestimate the psychology, even as people get older. So men in their 60s, 70s, we kind of write things off. But actually, men do want to have sex in their 60s and 70s. Men do want to kind of have a fulfilled life. And if they've lost a partner as people got older or separated, then that can have a profound effect, psychological effect. Whilst, of course, we know that erectile function does deteriorate after the age of 50, we also know, of course, the psychological aspects or the psychological play in all of this is very important.
In terms of medicinal prescriptions, basically, I mean, obviously, we've heard of many things in the past, but is this where you start prescribing where men are having issues, with erectile dysfunction?
As I said before, I mean, it's important to examine, take a history, a psychosocial history. It's important to document medications. Sometimes medications can sometimes impact upon fertility. It's important to make sure, of course, that they're not taking recreational drugs, not drinking too much, all of which can impact upon fertility. But most important is about health as well. So we know, for example, cardiovascular health is important. Your erectile function may be a barometer of your general health. So in that context, when we see patients, we often investigate them by doing blood tests, looking for diabetes. It's interesting that 70% of diabetics will have some degree of erectile dysfunction. In fact, 10% of diabetics newly diagnosed may present with erectile dysfunction as a manifestation of their diabetes. So we generally do hormone checks, looking at testosterone. There's a morning sample, look for diabetes, look at their cholesterol, look at their blood pressure as well, all factors which could impact upon erectile function. In particular, of course, surgeries. Patients may have had removal of their prostate for prostate cancer, previous chemotherapy, radiotherapy, all of which are important factors that may influence outcome. And I think in this day and age, it's probably not enough for us to simply say, well, look, we cured you of your cancer. But nowadays, because people are living longer, because treatments for cancer have improved, we also need to look at survivorship, and we need to look at survivorship outcomes, in particular focus on their quality of life and making sure that their actual overall health and well-being is improved in general, as opposed to simply relying on just the fact that you've got rid of their cancer. In terms of then investigation, once then afterwards we look at pills, and then we kind of look at the various medications and tablets that can be prescribed in this setting.
And so medication that's prescribed for erectile dysfunction may also have cause issues with fertility as well. Is that right?
No. I mean, generally speaking, fertility is not affected by drugs commonly such as sildenafil citrate, or if you want to call it more commonly Viagra or Cialis or tadalafil. There's very little evidence that they affect fertility as such in terms of sperm counts. There is some evidence in animal studies, but these are very, again, small studies. So generally speaking, they may actually enhance the couple's well-being, and particularly if we think about the stress that men have when women come towards their ovulation period, and therefore they're trying, and often they're put under a lot of stress at that point, as we said earlier, and therefore they may have erectile dysfunction secondary to that. So I think in that context, it's important, obviously, to sometimes prescribe a tablet to try and help them, give them confidence, which might therefore boost their kind of sexual function in that context. But generally speaking, there are, of course, general lifestyle measures. We talked about blood pressure, dealing with and taking the opportunity to use that assessment of the erectile function in a man or dysfunction to use to screen for other diseases, as we already mentioned, those kind of tests that we would do. But in most cases, we would start the male on Viagra or Cialis or various other medications that are available to try and boost and help erectile function. And the way they work is relaxing the muscle of the penis, giving an erection. Now, in some men, of course, that may not work. And therefore, we might need to then consider other forms or modalities of treatment that might be beneficial to them.
Basically, in terms of other causes of erectile dysfunction, I mean, are there any other that hasn't been mentioned already?
Yeah, there are many, many causes. We mentioned the psychological, we mentioned cardiovascular disease itself. There's also neurological problems, patients with MS who might have had a stroke, Parkinson's disease. Interestingly, patients who've had surgery, we mentioned radical prostatectomy, people have their prostate removed, which might damage the nerves to the penis itself. And endocrine problems, hormone problems, low testosterone levels, which might be secondary to a number of things. We also know as you get older, above the age of 40, 50 years of age, you have a condition called late onset hypogonadism, where the testosterone levels fall. That in itself might account for some of the reasons why men have more difficulty obtaining or sustaining an erection as they get older.
And I'm just thinking about in terms of advice for the couples. I mean, is there anything out there at all, any support to, you know, regarding their mental well-being?
Yeah, I think it's very important. Mental well-being is highly important in all of this. And I think that there are psychosexual therapists available. You can go see a GP to get a referral for that. If you feel that there's a lot of stress and psychology involved, marital therapy, sex therapy. So there are these specialists available in that. Often there's a combination of treatment of tablets and the use of psychosexual therapy in perhaps less complicated cases. But of course, in patients, we shouldn't forget the psychology in cancer patients as well. In those kind of patients who might have had treatments or surgery, then it becomes more complex because tablets themselves may not work. Psychosexual therapy itself may not work in that setting, and therefore they might need more invasive treatments, which consist of either using injections into the penis, pumps, or using creams to try and induce an erection directly. So in those cases, it can be quite complex. And eventually, if you look down the road, in some patients who might have had surgery, diabetic patients, or patients who have severe arteriovascular disease, in other words, patients who have cardiovascular disease, they may have blood flow to the penis that's impaired, the muscle in the penis is no longer functional. And in those kind of cases, there's a kind of third line therapy, we would put in penile implants or artificial devices in the penis in the form of either malleable or inflatable penile prosthetic devices to try and achieve an erection.
Do you think porn has an effect on people's relationships at all?
Yeah, I think it's a very, very important question. I mean, I think there are two aspects to that. I think the first aspect is about dysmorphophobia, in particular, the perception of the male has of his body, which can often cause anxiety, erectile problems, and body dysmorphophobia. In other words, if they look at porn, they look at guys on porn who might have a big penis, they kind of think, look at that and think, is that norm? Is that the way it should be? And often the ability, if interestingly, to sustain an erection or sustain ejaculation, you often see this kind of misconception that actually it takes a long time to ejaculate, you know, 20, 30, 40 minutes, which is, you know, actually wrong. So therefore, one has to be very careful about the implications or the social implications of all of this. Likewise, penile size, we talked about dysmorphophobia. They see somebody with a large penis and they think that's the norm, and they may therefore look at their own body image and feel susceptible in terms of that. So I think there's a lot to be said about the negative effects. And also, of course, men rely perhaps more and more on porn for masturbation, and therefore there are situations where men can get addicted to porn, and therefore that might have negative impacts on their relationship. Therefore, the only way perhaps that they can stimulate themselves and get an erection is by the use of pornography. So it has quite a negative impact as well. And I think if you get young people and you get kids in their adolescent years who rely more and more on this, they almost become immune to perhaps the more, you know, the more perhaps important aspects such as foreplay and also the relationship as well, and it loses that value. So I think, and there's enough evidence out there suggesting that.
I mean, in terms of, have you got like maybe a quick case study you can give us on how you helped someone who came to you with fertility issues, erectile dysfunction issues, and how you supported them through that?
Yeah, I think I think the most interesting aspect is the cultural aspect. So in many couples, perhaps from the Southern Asian subcontinent, who may have just got married, not had sex prior to marriage, and in that couple, there was particularly springs to mind in a couple where they clearly were new to sex, and they clearly the male partner thought he had erectile dysfunction, the female partner had what we thought was vaginismus or painful vagina when the male tried to have sex. And I think a lot of this was psychogenic in origin, but they were assessed, and we felt that overall this was about relationship building. And it's interesting that after psychosexual therapy, after the use of medications, they managed to conceive after a year, because it was about the frequency of intercourse. It was about the fact what was normal, what was abnormal, and was what they were experiencing normal, which was clearly what it was. And it was about reassurance about that. So often I think it's about reassurance in the context of in couples in that kind of situation.
Have you had more challenging cases than that one?
Yeah, I mean, there's always challenging cases. I think that in terms of relationships, I mean, one of the biggest challenges is in men who have a condition where they're not able to ejaculate. They're not able to orgasm to ejaculate. And that's usually a psychological effect. There could be many reasons psychologically for that. Equally, there can be neurological problems for that. But neurological problems aside, the commonest cause for failure to ejaculate or delayed ejaculation is usually psychological. So often men are unable to ejaculate, are they able to actually ejaculate in a partner despite the use of tablets, medications, stimulants, despite the use of other devices to try and help them ejaculate, and relationship and couple counselling. And in many rare cases, and it's not that common, we sometimes, when they're trying to have children and the female partner is older, we may have to try and extract sperm directly from their testicle to then use for IVF. But that's very rare. That's not that common. And in most instances, I think and believe a lot of these issues can be helped, as we said, by relationship counselling, by the use of perhaps medications. But psychological counselling is so important in those cases and those instances.
Has IVF treatment become more popular over the years? I mean, I hear about it much more now than ever before. So I'm guessing it's something that's become more popular.
Yeah, I think it's become more popularized, but I think it's become the default, really, in many cases, which is in many ways a good way. In many ways, however, is in a sense we have to question, because some of the patients may not necessarily need to go down the route of IVF treatment if they're actually assessed and analysed, as long as, of course, the female partner is what we term has got good ovarian reserve, good egg quality, and they're not too old in that sense. Of course, in most cases, the decision-making is left to clinicians who are extremely reputable. And in those instances, IVF still has a major role to play in couples, without a doubt, in order to achieve pregnancy. And let's face it, you know, the last 20, 30 years has been a major change. And a lot of couples are very happy and have been very successful in these type of treatments. I think where we fall short is probably perhaps we need to step back a little bit and perhaps investigate the male, as we said earlier, for many reasons, and try and see if we can improve the quality of life. And also, most importantly, use it as an opportunity for their general health, and to check their general health, and also advise them about long-term potential risks, as we talked about previously.
What advice can you give to men or couples having performance issues?
Well, I think the first instance is try and relax. It's easier said than done, isn't it? Particularly in the fertility context. So that's the one most important issue. I think it's about your health in general, live healthily. In terms of performance issues, it's about anxiety, isn't it? It's about trying to relax and trying to believe in yourself and your self-esteem and your self-confidence and believing in yourself. And that can, of course, that can be said about anything in life. But I think that the most important thing is trying to relax and trying to realize that it is a common problem and that you're not alone. And I think that, to me, is the most important message to get out there, is to say that, look, there are many, many couples who go through this. And it's just a fact that they don't talk about it. You know, and I think that many young guys will experience some form of erectile dysfunction throughout their life. And there's a lot of bravado, isn't there? There's something that not people won't talk about. People will kind of have these misconceptions, as we've talked about, pornography, the effects on social media, and most importantly about such an intimate subject and discussion. But I think if you're worried about performance anxiety, then see your GP, see an expert in the area, and make sure you deal with it. Because what you don't want it to do is go around in a circle in your mind and your head and make it affect your relationship, and try and deal with it early. It's interesting, when you talk about ED, often the guy will come on his own and won't often come with their partner. And that's always fascinated me to a degree, because if you look at fertility, of course, it's more the other way around. So perhaps we have different perceptions in terms of men and women about the expectations or one's expectations in life. And so I think it's a really important issue, but I think it's a couple's journey for both for erectile function and for infertility, and both should be involved or be proactive in that.
Professor Minnis, thank you for your time today. It's been really, really helpful for the information you've provided us. Is there any way people can find you, or is there a website to get more information if they need help around the challenges?
Sure. I mean, we have different websites. They can find me on the NHS, Imperial College Healthcare, would need a GP referral. We have a website called londonandrology.co.uk as well. But again, I would, you know, encourage people to approach their general practitioners if they're worried in any way, and who can then make an appropriate referral onwards to the specialists who would be best suited.
Thank you again. And thank you to all my listeners. You know, you can find me on Instagram at GavinJ417. Until next time, take care.